Welcome back to season 4 of the FASD Family Life Podcast. This is the only show about FASD hosted by an FASD specialist and a parent with 30 years lived experience. I'm Robbie Seal, your host and mom to 5 incredible kids, including 3 teens diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. As an FASD specialist, it is my passion to help families thrive. To learn more about me and my work, check out my website, FASDFamilyLife.ca. I started this podcast to be the friend I wish I had when my kids were young and to bring hope to weary parents. I wanted to share what I've learned in working in residential treatment and raising my own children impacted by trauma and prenatal alcohol exposure. I pour my heart, soul, and hundreds of unpaid hours into the production of the FASD Family Life podcast. And all that hard work's paying off. Since 2021, the podcast has grown to nearly 45,000 downloads worldwide. But I need your help to keep going and growing. Consider becoming a monthly sponsor. Your gift of $20 per month would enable me to keep sharing hope and teach the skills needed to reduce stress and improve the lives of people with FASD and the families who love them. And I've made it easy. There's a link in the show notes that says support the show. This is part of my world tour. In September 2022, I am embarking on a world tour where virtually I am going all around the world interviewing people who work in the spaces of FASD, raising awareness, advocacy, and supporting individuals with FASD and their families. Today, along my world tour, I am stopping in New Zealand to speak with Lee Henderson of FASCAN, and she's here with me today to tell me all about the remarkable work they're doing in New Zealand.
Thank you, Robbie, and thanks for having me on your wonderful podcast. So I am the chair of Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Care Action Network. It's a bit of a mouthful, so we call it FASD-CAN. The consequence of that is that many people in Canada think that it's a Canadian organisation. We have people try to join our organisation. They're welcome to do so, but of course, an organisation set up for caregivers and the professionals who support them in New Zealand. So it is the one central FASD resource in New Zealand. And interestingly, it grew out of trips that some of those early pioneers of FASD in New Zealand made to Canada many years ago. And in 2013, the idea sprang following one of those trips to actually start the organisation here. Very much a grassroots organisation of parents. And the first few years was mainly aimed at developing support networks and resources for those in New Zealand with FASD, and we did rely heavily and continue to rely heavily on Canadian resources, although we're now picking up resources from our sisters across the way in Australia. NoFASD has some wonderful resources, and we work with them, and of course those in Europe as well. A lot of the early action was to input into the government-developed a FASD action plan in New Zealand. It was supposed to run 2016 to 2019. It was a very good action plan in terms of looking at diagnosis and support and youth justice and education. But at the end of 3 years, we had a significant concern that it really hadn't fulfilled many of its promises. And some of that work is continuing today, but perhaps in a slightly less structured way than we would have liked to see it 10 years ago. But FASD-CAN has had input into that and input into some of the ongoing projects, such as the development of New Zealand-specific diagnostic guidelines, some of the youth justice work, some of the intervention work. So we continue to be involved on the research there. But most importantly for us is that in 2020, we received our first government funding. Up until then, we'd been relying on $10 subscriptions from parents for many years. So you can imagine how we were running on an oily rag. The government funding is still pretty limited. I wouldn't say it's anywhere near close to meet the needs of family in New Zealand, but it just gave us that push to be able to start to think bigger, to think yes. what we could do. And we got our first navigator in just one region a year ago, pilot project, to be evaluated by the Ministry of Health in terms of future government's funding. Again, not enough, but just enough for us to step by step make our way up to start to employ people and to start to develop some of our resources. So I guess our other big activity, and it's one which I see reflected in other countries as well, is to have FASD recognised as a disability in New Zealand. At the moment, you can only get disability support if you have an ID below below 70, 10 to 20% of the population. So for most people, it's unsupported, and particularly an issue in early years through education, which is probably the most critical time to actually stop all those secondary characteristics coming into play.
FASD is not recognized yet as a disability within your disability services. What about within your school systems? Is there some education happening within those systems to provide extra supports at school?
So it's a huge issue. There are some good schools and there are some not so good schools. Most of the education system in New Zealand is publicly funded. There are a few special residential schools around the country. It's been very hard for people with FASD to get in there because they don't have that learning support or identification. Mm-hmm. And there is concern by many that actually segregation is a breach of human rights. So we're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place, that many of the mainstream schools are insufficient. There's insufficient understanding of accommodation of the children there, but nowhere else to go. So over the last 2 years, in particular, probably 5 or 6 years, we've put a lot of priority into education, inclusive education, joining with other disability organisations. We're developing our own resources. We provide, and this is all volunteer advocacy within schools. Recently done a well-supported webinar on how to advocate within schools. So, yeah.
Very good. Yes. It takes a certain skill to be able to advocate within the schools and to be able to have the school classroom teachers and the administrators actually listen to a parent. You likely run into the same challenges that many parents do, and that is that you may get sidelined as a parent rather than looked at really the well-informed parent that you are, the one who's advocating for your child's best needs or best interest. But also, if the teacher is supporting the child the way they need to be supported, the teacher's going to have a lot better day too. You know, it's going to ease the day for everyone. But sometimes yes. we often get sidelined because we get labeled just parent.
Yes, I love the, I saw a hashtag yesterday on Twitter, which is a lived experience expert. And I thought that's very useful to actually say we are the experts, because one of the things that we have run up against in terms of special schools is that the evidence is that children don't do as well in special schools, they would be better in the home environment. And maybe the evidence is there, but often the family are the ones that know what's best for their child. And there's a sort of dichotomy between academic evidence and that experience of a parent who knows that maybe putting their child into a very large urban school where they may get lost, where they may get into antisocial influence and so on, is not, but they may not appear to be lost because they've got FASD. It's sort of unique, you know, it's different than other disabilities. To argue that there is times when it really has to be the right choice for the child. Yeah.
Well, each individual with FASD is completely unique. So you're not going to have one solution that fits every person with FASD. There are some large brush strokes that will cover many, but we always have to put the individual at the center of that and try to find the solution that fits both the family and the individual. Yes, I agree. Mm-hmm. All right, let's hear more about the work you're doing.
We've used our sister organisation, NoFASD. We've taken the excellent caregiver's handbook that they made and adapted it for New Zealand resources. One of the things that's in our mind at all times is while we can take overseas resources, we have to put the bicultural influence on, or it's important. Maori are disproportionately affected by FASD in New Zealand, and they have a unique culture. We have a unique system in terms of bicultural and co-governance and involvement. So what we do in New Zealand is to develop resources that take account of that. We've got a long way to go. It's still a learning curve for us, but our resources that we're developing, we've recently made a new website, and we hope that that will be the go-to website in New Zealand for all things FASD. It's got information for professionals as well as for caregivers, as well as for those for FASD, a fairly lively website. And through that, we're running webinar series, and developing other resources. So done our own around advice to police and other
people. I saw that. I was looking at your website, and it's beautiful and very easy to navigate. So well done. I'll put a link in the show notes so anybody who is interested can look at that. I saw the double-sided flyer that you've developed for interacting with police. I thought that was really good. And the family handbook, or the handbook, FASD handbook, as you acknowledged, bicultural and bilingual. I see that the Maori language is integrated in there as well. So I thought that was really culturally sensitive and very appropriate. And yeah, it's a beautiful website.
Thank you very much. And of course, these days, the government will not fund anything that is not bicultural in some way. New Zealand's changing quite rapidly in that direction. So there is an obligation, and we want to do it. Maori were disproportionately affected by alcohol. It was one of the few cultures where there was no exposure to alcohol before colonisation, and the consequence of the greater harm to the Maori population is that there is an inequity. And there's recently been a three-day hearing on FASD under the Waitangi Tribunal, which is a tribunal that addresses the outcomes of the agreement between the Crown and Maori from the 1840s. And hopefully some further government action could come out of that. You know, that might be the way, rather than the other advocacy that we're doing for FASD more generally, because the needs are the same for services, for support and so on.
Very much so.
Yes, and the other thing, I'm perhaps more an advertisement for NoFASD, but they've recently launched their transition handbook. And this is where we're really trying to push our emphasis now. I guess because our organisation started with a lot of parents who had young adopted kids who are now all young adults. So we're seeing a whole different series of issues. And the Australian book is very Australian specific in terms of resources that are available around housing, employment and so on. But that's where we would like to go. We need funding for that. What we have to do here with our organisation is to get funding for appropriate projects and so on. But we've got that on our radar, and we had a wonderful meeting with some of your change makers. Quite inspiring. We're having Valerie McGinn, who is New Zealand's expert on FASD, a clinical psychologist in Auckland, has got her first pizza. But we would like to build that up. We don't have the voice of FASD in New Zealand, and we don't have a strong voice for birth mothers. So those are two areas that we see in other countries, a lot of development. And interestingly, tomorrow in New Zealand, there's a new ministry being launched, and it's the Ministry for Disabled People. But as far as we can see, at this stage, FASD is not part of that ministry because we're not considered to be.
Who of us are surprised? You know, under the Ministry of Canada, Disability Services in Canada, FASD isn't recognized either. CAN-FASD, so flip that around. CAN-FASD, the Canadian FASD Research Network, you know that word, but I'll just say that for others, just issued a paper, a statement again today saying that for the Canadian Disability Tax Credit, most of the time, individuals with FASD are, or 50% of the time anyway, they're rejected, have to go through appeals. And even those who have FASD perhaps have been granted approval for a tax credit have to reapply every 3 to 5 years, you know, just in case their FASD goes away. You know, so again, it's not recognized as this is a permanent lifelong whole body disability, brain and whole body disability. This is something somebody is born with and lives their whole life with, not just a childhood illness. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing because, I mean, you've got prevalence data, which is something that we don't have. So the foundation of the cost analysis that should be sufficient to make a difference. It's baffling. And I think, you know, I often wonder why it is so hard, not just here, but internationally. And really pleased to see the actions to change the stigmatisation against birth mothers, against people raising those and individuals with FASD, because it has to be an acceptance that society has to accept before the politicians. The politicians are not leading this issue.
Well, yeah, you know, who's going to lead the way is the grassroots. Just as in New Zealand, it was the parents and the caregivers who were desperate for services and desperate for a network, started a network, you know, FASD can, and then pulling on the resources or the data from other countries to help you, you know, find your way and provide those supports. I guess it's going to have to be the grassroots, all of us writing to our members of parliament, all of us writing to our ministers of the legislative assemblies, whatever our government systems are, writing to them and pressuring them. I mean, autism was able to do it many years ago with the parents organizing and pushing and making it a recognized disability. And I guess that's what we're going to have to do. I know Canada still doesn't have a national strategy on FASD that we've been hammering away for decades already. We don't have a national strategy. You mentioned NoFASD in Australia. They do. Like Australia government has already has in the 10 years of action and work that's been happening from NoFASD, there's already a national strategy. So congratulations to our counterparts in Australia for the fine work they're doing and to the Australian government who's recognized that.
You just sparked off for me an issue which is around the United Nations Convention on People with Disabilities. And in New Zealand, we've been fortunate to have a wonderful disability commissioner and a children's commissioner. They've got the right to talk directly to the Prime Minister on matters of major significance. We helped and they prepared a wonderful report on abuse and really or lack of compliance with the United Nations Convention on Disabled People. And this, it went to the Prime Minister. It's still sitting there with promises, yes, we'll do something about it. So a little frustrating. We actually went public with it on last year's FASD Day. But this year, New Zealand is being reviewed, the five-year review under the United Nations Convention. It's an opportunity potentially for some of those issues. And I am aware that in Australia as well, there's also, CanFASD's also got the report on the human rights. So interesting if there could be some international movement that every country that, you know, when review cycles are coming up would actually be putting in on that, because there certainly are rights around rights to education, rights to, you know, normal living that should be applied to those with FASD.
Yeah, absolutely. Like education, we think of the early intervention that is so important. And, you know, one of the most protective factors is to have an early diagnosis, and that is elusive. And most people with FASD don't get that diagnosis at all, let alone an early diagnosis. And yet, if we can recognize FASD early, then we can put early childhood supports in place, including training the parents, birth parents, grandparents, adoptive foster parents, whoever they are. They need specialized training in, as to how to raise their child with FASD, because typical parenting doesn't work because these children, their brains work differently. They can learn, they can grow, but we need a very special way of approaching these situations. And of course, as you just said, the right to education, individuals with FASD require a special kind of education. And then what about the right to employment after we're finished the education system? You know, without employment, up goes the rates of mental health, despair, poverty, addiction, homelessness, incarceration. But if we had employment, if we had supportive services, we could eliminate a lot of those other social issues.
Yes, and I think you're touching on some of the, it is a stigma issue, or tied in with stigma, is that many people do not want to acknowledge themselves as having FASD when they go into employment. My son would fit in that category, and he's done some quite amazing stuff. He was trained as a chef, and he would work 50, 60 hours a week under high-pressure chef environment, you know, making breakfast for 50 people within an hour or whatever is, you know, it's not the best choice for somebody with FASD, and there is burnout. But yes, but that self-acknowledgement is actually quite difficult, I think. Yes, and also convincing employers of the value of having somebody employed by FASD. So
complicated issues and lots of work to be done to destigmatize fetal alcohol spectrum disorder as, you know, something shameful. It's not something shameful. It's a disability. We know the cause, unlike some other things like autism. Perhaps we don't know the cause. FASD is clearly identified, and then we can lay blame. But it serves no one to lay blame. And it's really unfair because, you know, up until now, do most people in New Zealand even understand that drinking alcohol while pregnant is harmful? Or do we still have doctors that are saying, no, it's okay. A little bit here, a little bit there is okay.
We occasionally hear that that's the case. Certainly a great increase in awareness over the last few years. We are quite lucky in New Zealand. We've got a couple of long-term studies. One is the Growing Up in New Zealand study, which did look at the levels of drinking. So we know that 71% drank before their pregnancy was recognised, and 23% continued, around 23, I mightn't have the figures exactly right, continued to drink through their first trimester of pregnancy. So we've actually used our figures. We haven't got a prevalence study, as I said, but we can base it on the Canadian study and what we know of the levels of drinking to be able to say that, yes, it's likely to be 3 to 5%, which is figures that are, should be sufficient to be able to evaluate what services and what the needs are. Yes, we've had some reasonable publicity campaigns, and yay, next year we'll have compulsory labelling on our alcohol. We're years behind Canada, and I love when you go into a bar in Canada and you've got plaques on the wall about pregnancy and so on. I mean, we had so many arguments just to get a tiny little label on a bottle, but at least we had something that said it was about lifelong damage.
That's another level of awareness. It's a caution, you know, and maybe somebody sees that and they never knew that before. So it's a point of at least a conversation and a warning, and hopefully it will help. In Canada, we don't have those compulsory labels on alcohol containers. Some bars, restaurants, and liquor stores do have those posters that warn that there's no safe amount of alcohol during pregnancy. So that's a very important work. Good. And that way servers, bartenders, managers can be aware as well. And the general public, so they can be careful and supportive of a woman who's making the choice not to drink during her pregnancy.
I was in Winnipeg 3 or 4 years back, and the first thing I saw the bus coming from the airport was a bus covered in the sign about no alcohol in pregnancy.
Wow.
I thought that was absolutely amazing. I found around Winnipeg a lot of publicity around alcohol, very, very impressive. So, again, you know, it would be good for us to be able to pick something up like that. But those are expensive campaigns, I guess.
They are expensive campaigns. So congratulations, Winnipeg, for the bus ads. That's wonderful. I have a friend who has FASD. She lives in Victoria. So that's on the west coast of Canada. And she campaigned and did a GoFundMe page and raised enough money to have bus ads in her community. I think she had two buses and they had ads with talking about no safe amount of alcohol during pregnancy, or, you know, if you're pregnant, don't drink. And just through her own energy and her own campaign raising money, she was able to get that done. So yeah, where there's a will, there's a way.
Well, that's an inspiration, because we're just developing, in fact, we put on our website last night the beginnings of our campaign for FASD Day. So maybe we'll add that to it. That's a great idea. Thank you.
Wonderful. What are your plans for FASD Day?
We've got writing to MPs. We've got marches. We've got media campaigns.
Yeah. Wonderful.
And we actually have our own red-shoed kiwi.
Do you? You have a red-shoed kiwi?
Well, last year we had Hugh Fero, which means red shoes in Maori, who went various places around the country just to bring up messages.
Oh, fun. So, well, maybe you can have a little T-shirt with the kiwi with the little red shoes on it or something like that. I know Australia has their animals. They've got 5 animals with their red shoes, and Canada's got 5 animals, I think, with red shoes, including the Canada goose and stuff. So it's pretty fun to just add some fun to the campaign work that we're doing.
That's right. Yes.
Wonderful. Yeah. So the prevalence rate, you said, is between 3 to 5%
yep.
in New Zealand. You're working on this big push for FASD Day, trying to get a national strategy happening and a national action plan. So it's a lot of great work. And this is all started by volunteers and families. And now you have some government funding in your office. Are you able to go out and do some training for teachers in the schools? How is that going for you all?
So our navigator in Auckland has been really active. She's worked on the marae, which is the marae is the Maori meeting place in South Auckland, a big Maori community. And 2 weeks back, she started our first training course. And for caregivers, we're also running online courses. Mm-hmm. I should at this point acknowledge Claire Guide because she was the founder of FASD after coming to the Canadian Conference. She's done a lot of developing the resources and was the face of FASD in New Zealand as well in terms of caregivers. So yes, training is critical. We're looking for money to be able to spread that more nationwide and to move our focus, because we're a virtual organisation, we're run by a volunteer board and we're all scattered all over the country. But what we do want is more regional focus so that people, some more face-to-face and local people who know about what services and so on are available, because even without disability services, there are other things where you can approach, other supports and so on. So a lot more regional to really get to the grassroots. I mean, in a way, we've got a disadvantage that we're a small country, but in another way, it's positive. We're run by one government, not multiple governments like yourselves in Australia. Amazingly, the New Zealand psyche is to very independent people, I guess. Mm. And so everything gets set up differently. So you've got different support services in every city and so on, different providers. So you can't just tell everybody, oh, well, you've got a diagnosis, this is what you do. You say, oh, you've got a diagnosis, but where are you? Okay, you're in Christchurch, so you'll have to go to this one. But if you're Auckland, you're going to get... So sort of that directory and inventory and being able to have all of that is also another aspect of some of our future work.
Mm-hmm. Be nice to have a database on your website. Somebody types in looking for services and if they just put in their postal code or their address, it would direct them to the services. That would be really helpful. And that system navigator being able to point people in different directions, but she's only in one region, so you need more. So this takes more money,
Yes.
We could do everything if we have enough money and time.
No shortage of ideas, that's right.
That's right. Are there diagnostic clinics?
Well, we're developing our own diagnostic guidelines. See, best practice in those that is used by some clinics are just a direct adaptation of the Canadian guidelines. But there are some district health boards that perhaps do a more cut-down approach. The issue is the cost. You know, a day and a half is what it takes at least, plus flying to places, all of those costs and so on for a full diagnosis. There would be there's a significant concern about reaching sufficient diagnostic capacity in New Zealand. I mean, we're seeing an increase all of the time, but there's still, maybe 2-year waiting lists. And unfortunately, to get a diagnosis is often either very bad behaviour, getting involved in the justice system, or your parents can afford to pay $9,000 to get a diagnosis.
Yeah.
It's just very difficult. So what the government is funding is a review of the diagnostic guidelines that will involve looking internationally as well and recommendations for a standard practice. That will be a great advantage. It's probably going to be a couple of years before that happens. And hopefully, we will eventually get more. But I've seen the figures quoted from other countries that maybe only 1% will ever actually get diagnosed. And I think that's part, I guess, of the reason that it's been so hard to have this recognised as a disability. Or even, if you encompass disability, what is a probable FASD in the absence of exposure? I know in New Zealand, some clinics won't even start a diagnosis without having history of birth family drinking, whereas it seems to me, from my point of view, you're best to know what the brain domains are and, whether it is, and then you call it probable because you don't know about the drinking exposure of the fetus during pregnancies. But I think that's what the government is grappling with, is probable FASD, and what about all of those who are showing those effects but are never going to get a diagnosis? And I think that's one of the obstacles, as well as the stigma, as well as the cost. It's actually the difficulty of putting that into legislation.
Makes a lot of sense. It's a very complicated issue, and it is very difficult. It's difficult for diagnosticians to make these diagnoses. I mean, they can do all their brain examinations and, or in terms of brain function examinations, and to see, you know, what is their gross motor skills or fine motor skills? How do they perform on psychological testing? You know, what are their growth? You know, all these speech and language, all these different criteria to examine the 10 brain domains to see if there is significant impact or sufficient impact to go for a probable FASD. But we need that maternal confirmation here in Canada as well to have that diagnosis. But as we wrap up, we have a couple more minutes here, Lee. What would be your message to the folks in New Zealand?
That we are changing, that we're seeing increased awareness, that we're seeing increased professional development, but we've all got a role to play to keep up the advocacy, to tell our stories. They're always powerful. Help to get funding so that we can do all of those things that are needed to support those with FASD. Be hopeful.
And be hopeful. The struggle is real, and so is success, as I always say. But, you know, those who are in New Zealand and good friends of New Zealand, you can always look at FASCAN's Facebook page and their Instagram and any other social media they have, and you can like and follow. That also helps raise awareness. They have posts that you relate with. Share those posts. If you hear this podcast and you enjoy it, share it with other people. That just helps raise awareness and helps bring that emphasis of the work that we're all doing to the forefront so that we can affect some change on the government level and on the grassroots.
Thank all you, right. Robbie, for giving us a voice. Really appreciate that.
My honor.
Are you looking for a community of support? You've heard me say it so many times. We need our tribe. If you need your tribe, I encourage you to join the FASD Family Life Community. Together, we will deepen our understanding of FASD and build a community of support with parents who understand. The FASD Family Life Community Support Group meets on the third Tuesday of every month at 6 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, and I hope to see you there. You can subscribe at fasdfamilylife.ca. Thank you for spending your time with me. I know it's precious. And until next week, remember, the struggle is real, and so is success. I'll speak with you soon.